Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. My name's Nicola Cairncross, and today we're switching things up a bit. We're going to be doing something a little bit different. So we've looked over the previous episodes, the last 52 episodes, in fact, and we've picked out extracts that sum up what we think's brilliant about the podcast. For myself, well, I was really spoilt for choice. Stephanie reminded me about an episode we did called Investing in Yourself as a Writer. I listened back to it and I really was hard pushed to pick anything out in particular because it was a really cracking episode. We shared a techie tip. Susanna Marriott from the Professional Writers Academy gave a load of great advice and also talked about the thorny problem of can you actually teach someone how to write? We think on balance, yes, you can, because if you give people the right tools and the right tuition, it gives their inner creativity time to grow. As is typical in our Write Club episodes, we had a very lively discussion about something that seems not very important, but we all feel very passionately about. We had a discussion about pens. But the bit I'm going to play to you now is a discussion we were having about investing in yourself as a writer, whether you're investing time or money. We heard a bit about Linda's background in this extract, which might surprise you all. And Stephanie reveals why she really wants to go back and do a creative writing degree, while Teresa and I concentrate on what's really important in life.
Don't underestimate being surrounded by people who are passionate about the same thing
that
you are.
The only thing more infectious than enthusiasm is the lack of it.
Yes.
So you can surround yourself with enthusiastic people. Now, Linda, you actually have a degree in writing, don't you?
Yes, I was very fortunate. Many years ago, I went back as an older student and I went to graduate school at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
That's in America.
Yes, it is. They have a creative writing program. And so I went there and I earned my master's degree in creative writing. And the great benefit for me of this was when you join this program, and they're very selective about, you get to the people who are your fellow students from everywhere and with all kinds of backgrounds and different, but they're all talented. When I went into it, I think I was always giving over to other people's opinions. Oh, this isn't right because this, that he said this or whatever. Not taking offense, but just thinking I need to improve. Sometimes you do. But one of the valuable things was I learned when to trust myself with all of this. Yeah. And that was a great thing. Exposed to some very good teachers and fellow students. And just was all set to go out in the world and write the Great American Novel when I got done. But then I couldn't do that, so I had to get a job. I'm still working on it. But I also was able to attend a lot of summer writers' conferences. Mm. That was really valuable because then you are, once you're accepted, you're assigned one of the, the guest successful people to come along and read your work and to have interviews with you and talk with you about what's wrong or what's right or what you need to do. Those things are very valuable.
Right. How did you know you could write? Had you done a degree before?
I didn't finish high school in the beginning and eventually made my way to the University of Rhode Island with the support of, very supportive late husband. And I'd always wanted to write. I always did write little things, but nothing really consequential. So I've always wanted to do these. Then when I had the opportunity to really go back to school, I was just on fire. I just loved every minute. Yeah. I said it was like a duck to water. And then when I was accepted at Brown, I was just in heaven, Mm-hmm. So
that's my ambition.
Yeah, to be accepted at Brown.
No, not to be accepted at Brown. Well, both, yeah. No, I would like to go to university and do a degree in creative writing. Yeah, I'd love to do that.
But certainly, why would you need it now?
It's a question of enjoyment. I would love to do that. Obviously, smoke and drink and way around.
Absolutely.
Sleep my way through the student unit. No, I'm joking. I wouldn't want to do that at all. And if my husband is listening, I definitely wouldn't want to do that. No, I'm jesting. But no, I would love the the stimulus.
I've got to say, I didn't go to university at all, but and had no dream to do it at the time because I came straight out of school. And I was accepted to art college as a 21-year-old, and I did really enjoy that. Mm. But the thought of going back and doing a creative writing degree actually really appealed, just to be surrounded by people. And again, to put yourself in the environment where you're expected
and
to
and
read.
I think as a mature student, because I did my degree, you know, I wasn't particularly old. I was about 26 when I went, but I was a mature student compared to many people there. You do appreciate every minute, and you certainly aren't thinking, can I skip a class or whatever.
No.
You want to be there, and
the
biggest frustration is when perhaps other people in a given seminar group are not enthusiastic or not
mucking
prepared, and you know, and you're the only one that's engaging with your tutor. That can be frustrating at times, but yeah, definitely as a mature student, you get so much more out of it because you know why you're there.
Yeah,
one of the wonderful things that we had there with that I should mention is that the instructors there, who were people who had success in the publishing world and who were respected, one was Robert Coover at the time, and then I had John Hawkes, who's a real academics writer. Academics really loved him. He was rather avant-garde. And Castle, R.B. Castle was one, he says. They would have you in their homes and have little, you know, like a little cocktail parties where they would bring in people that they know that...
Living the dreams.
Well, they would say they were
pretty old times. I'm thinking they really lovely follow-ups.
They were usually catered affairs. And
is it really lunchtime?
Will you shut up and let me talk? But the idea was to expose us to others who had success.
What am I going to be doing in the new year? In the spirit of this episode, I've actually signed up for a creative writing course, and it's hosted by Curtis Brown Creative. That's my Christmas present to myself, and I'm really looking forward to it. You'll be hearing about it on the podcast as I go through it. And I really hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Have an absolutely fantastic 2019, won't you?
Hi, Heather here. A happy new year to you all. We have great fun recording our podcasts, and I'm beginning to understand that you have fun listening. My favourite episode was the one based on fantasy. This is my favourite genre, and I was especially pleased to guess the novel on the first clue.
Name the novel.
Have you got your pens poised?
Oh, yes. I'll give it up. Bringing one.
I have three clues. Well, this is your genre.
Yes, that's true.
I have three clues for you, and they will get easier as time goes on. And by the time I get to the third clue, you'll all know. Okay, this book was published in 1983. The main character is an incompetent and cynical wizard who is hired as a guide to the rich Twoflower, who's an insurance clerk from the Agatian Empire.
I know.
I don't.
I've got a guess at the author, so I won't get the novel.
Right. This novel is the first in a 41-book series.
Oh, mm-hmm. 41.
Okay. It's a comic fantasy taking place on a flat planet, which is carried through space on the backs of four
elephants. Oh, got it now.
Who themselves stand on the shell of a giant sea turtle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've got to name the novel.
No, I can't.
Not
I can
the
name
series
the author
books.
And the series, but not the novel.
Okay. I think I can do that, but yeah, I haven't a clue.
Okay. It's going to be a guessing out of the 41.
Heather knows it already.
Right, and clue number three, the author died tragically from early onset Alzheimer's in March 2015, leaving his daughter Rehan to carry on his work.
Go for it, Heather.
Terry Pratchett.
Yes.
Yep. And is it The Colour of Magic?
It is.
Which
is from the Discworld series.
As I said, I think I've read all 40,
I think so.
And it is one of my favourites.
It's an amazing series of books that I haven't read.
I've just had to get one light.
Yeah, lovely.
say
it. Yeah, Terry Pratchett. And I have to say, when I chose that book as the name of the novel, I thought, you know, I might give it a try. I might give fantasy a try because it looks like a lot of fun. Yeah. A lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm really so sad that the stories aren't going to continue, because I want to know what happens to Rincewind and the witches and all the characters that are in the books.
Mm.
Because obviously, even if somebody else kind of picks it up and writes, it's not going to be Terry Pratchett's original ideas.
No.
And it's just fantastic.
His daughter has said, because he said he's very happy for her to carry on. Rhianna, his daughter, is a professional writer of many years standing. He was knighted in 2009 and made an OBE in 1998. Actually, his last years after he got early onset Alzheimer's were astonishingly active, because he learnt to dictate rather than type.
Huh.
And the last Discworld novel was completed and delivered the summer before he died.
Wow,
in July.
That's fantastic.
And he also donated $1 million to Alzheimer's Research UK and became its patron. In The Light Fantastic, which was published in 1986, a librarian is turned into an orangutan by a spell. It suits him because it means people give him lots of bananas. But the orangutan was so popular with readers that he reappeared in most of the following books. And that, in turn, led to Terry Pratchett getting involved with the Orangutan Foundation. In 1995, he went to Borneo with a TV crew and made a film about them. So, you know, remarkable man. Some of the quotes: all stupidity beats artificial intelligence every time.
Yeah.
From the Hogfather. Yeah. You know, I mean, he's just got some great lines, brilliant lines.
I've got a collection of his writings and things that he delivered, lectures and stuff, and an account of it, of his dementia. It's on my Kindle, but if anybody ever wants to borrow it, borrow my Kindle to have a look at it. It's so sad, but he just dealt with it so brilliantly.
Yeah.
And one of the stories is that he was typing one day and he realised that as he looked at his keyboard, he couldn't see the letter O. He couldn't find it on the keyboard. And at that moment, he decided he stopped driving, because he said if he could lose a letter on a typewriter, he could miss a child crossing the road or something. Yeah. Just amazing.
Mm.
It's well worth a read. It's good. And I think, as I
we'll
think,
put a link to that as well as the first of the 41 Discworld ones.
Yeah. You know, in science fiction, June, the last book, the last books of June were finished by Frank Herbert's son. So there is a tradition of that happening, and I don't see why she shouldn't have a go at it.
And maybe she will. It's just, I was just sad because, you know,
Rhianna said that she won't do any new stories. She will only concentrate on spin-offs and projects arising from existing characters. Yeah. But she is an established writer in her own right.
Oh, she is. As you can tell, I'm a big fan.
I'm a big fan, and you know, I honestly do credit the Discworld series to getting me into sci-fi, because I didn't understand the difference between science fiction and fantasy when I was a kid, so I just read absolutely everything. But I went right through that series, and, you know.
Yeah. And he's very much in the genre of fantasy.
Thank you, Steph. I'm so glad I got one right. I loved our interview with Peter Flannery. It was a privilege to interview him.
If you look at a lot of things that are written, or films or TV series, they tend to be based on certain structures, certain models. And the most common ones are things like the Sherlock Holmes model. So whether it's Miss Marple or Poirot or Gregory House, or, you know, any of these things, that you start off with a brilliant mind and the physical sidekick. So anything that has that kind of model is basically drawing from the Sherlock Holmes model. Now, people broaden that out and they use maybe the Robin Hood model. So you've got Robin Hood, Will Scarlet, Maid Marian, and then Little John, who's the big sort of physical presence. And then you normally have some kind of father figure, whether it's Friar Tuck or Herne the Hunter in the background. And if you look at the way that is translated through books, if you take Star Wars, for instance, you've got Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Robin Hood, Little John, Maid Marian, Princess Leia, Chewbacca's there, and then you've got Obi-Wan Kenobi in the background. So that's very much based on the Robin Hood model. And that carries through Star Wars. It goes into Harry Potter. The reason why people have these characters is because they allow you to explore the parts of human nature people are really interested in. If you take any of those characters out, you lose a certain interaction.
Yeah.
So you need the friendship. You need, you don't need, but often you have that love interest. So you've got a romantic element. You need that relationship with parents. But if you have parents, parents are there to look after the children. So this is why you nearly always find characters in stories that are the heroes, and nearly always orphaned, or they've lost their parents in some way. because that means that they have to carry the responsibility.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but you still need that interaction with a senior figure. So this is why you have characters like Obi-Wan Kenobi or Dumbledore, or in my case, the Emissary. They give you that wisdom of a more mature person. And that allows you to have those interactions so the person can grow, they can show the naivety, and they can take on the wisdom of these older people. And then that gives you another progression through the story. So yeah, my characters, every now and again, a character will surprise you. You'll invent someone and you suddenly realize they're going to play a much bigger part than you anticipated. And sometimes you just get characters that are fun and you really like, and then you can't shut them up. You know, they keep sort of popping in.
Yeah.
So I think whenever you're thinking about characters, you need to establish how the reader is going to feel about these characters. Mm. So that's the most important part. So it doesn't really matter whether they love your characters or hate your characters. They need to feel something about them. And the reason for that is so that when the plot develops, you want your reader to feel that sense of motivation. So when an evil character does something nasty, it should feel nasty. But you should also have the sense that at some point, that baddie is going to get his comeuppance.
Hi, this is Linda. My wish for you in the coming year is that it will be filled with fun. May you find frequent opportunities to let your inner child come out and play and have lots of laughter. Over the past year, my favorite episodes dealt with writing humor. I've chosen two short excerpts on the subject. First with Charlie Bell, who along with his writing buddy Ian, write under the pseudonym Eddie Nugent, author of Picking Up the Brass and Map of Africa, with the third book in progress. Then we'll hear from Chris Heath. Both of them speak to keeping it honest.
One of Ian's flaws was Ian tended to write Americanisms, and we were writing about an English guy. So in the writing process and discussion, we took those flaws out by kind of hybridizing the things that Ian was saying, the things that I was saying, to get one style. And one of my flaws was to try and jam a few too many jokes into one page. So where that was found out was when we were published, the editor, the chap who from Monday Books, Dan Collins, it's his imprint, but he also did the editing of both our books. And he set about it with a pickaxe, basically, and kind of said, look, you know, you don't need to keep doing it. You know, there's one paragraph here and you've tried to be funny four or five times in the same paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to. You need to take out two of the jokes. And, although that process is kind of painful, we're all a bit sensitive and we don't like to hear that what we've written isn't good or perhaps needs some sort of modification or amendment, but it's a very worthwhile process to go through. You come out with a slightly thicker skin, but also, certainly for us anyway, when we'd seen what he'd done to it, we immediately said, he's absolutely right, isn't he? It scans quicker, you read it quicker. The truth, as you described earlier on, is still there. You can follow what's going on, but you're not kind of, you know, like, I suppose you'd compare it to, you know, those comedians that, you have comedians that tell stories about their lives, people like Mickey Flanagan, the Cockney comedian, and then you have other comedians who tell hundreds of jokes, and you only ever remember three or four of them.
Yeah.
Is it Tim Vine? Who does, they're all two-liners that he does, but he'll do two-line jokes for an hour and a half, but you only ever remember a handful of them. They're all quite funny, but you only remember a handful. I think you run the risk of doing that. If you kind of try and jam too much humour in there, then that's what you're going to do. People start to get bored of it, don't they?
In this next excerpt, we will hear from an interview Steph and I recorded with Chris Heath, author of the children's series The World According to Grandpa. Again, he speaks about sticking with the rules.
So there's two books out already.
Yeah.
Mentioned a third. How many more are going to be coming after that? How many are you planning?
I'm planning on not stopping.
Right. That's good.
There's the third one will be out hopefully in the next
5 or 6 weeks. That is Why Do the Seasons Change? And then I've got another 2 coming up after that, which are Why Do We Have Names? And How Is Electricity Made?
Oh, I've always wanted to know. I've asked so many people.
Grandpa would be able to tell you that, as a spoiler, electricity was made via the eggs of a small chicken in Chandigarh, India.
Oh, I never would have guessed.
Yeah, and the best thing about that, from at the very end of that book, the chicken bends over and farts out a great big fireworks display, just to finish the book. It's, you know, so good being childish.
That's going to be a wonderful read.
That's going to be a favourite with the children, isn't it?
So if you're looking for a cheap laugh, all you need to mention is either a cat being sick or, you know, or somebody trumping.
Any of the bodily functions for
children. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You've given us some topics that are coming out. And where do they come from? You're driving around and it hits you in the head and you run off the road or something.
Yeah, I use the notes function of my iPhone a lot. I'll write down either little jokes or lines or ideas. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, in the How Is Electricity Made, which will be the 5th book, that I knew that I wanted to have this one particular chicken that laid electric eggs, and that's where all electricity came from. Because I like the idea that at some point I wanted to make a joke about battery hens.
So you start with the joke and then build the story.
Yeah, often. I mean, there's lots of different ways of doing it. Sometimes you backwards engineer it from one joke. Sometimes you agonize about getting the plot right. Because once you've got the Bible of the internal logic of what you're writing, it has to follow the rules of its own internal logic. Otherwise, it's cheating. Mm-hmm. And it may seem like in nonsensical fantasy like Grandpa's Lies, there aren't those kind of links, but they're just as present, the rules of this logic that you have to follow, otherwise it doesn't make sense.
Right.
For example, in the 4th book, there's a series of monsters that live inside the earth who change the seasons because of the thermostat.
Oh, good.
And I had to think of a way of making them stop doing that when they didn't want to, because they changed the temperature to suit themselves. Each monster has a season. And it was only when I realized that they could be bribed with rhubarb. Because otherwise, why would a monster stop doing something it wanted to do? It wouldn't. It would just carry on, because it's a monster and it can do whatever it wants.
That's right.
So there had to be something in it for the monster, tangible.
Right.
So, you know, that took a few days to realize that they needed rhubarb. To be a bribe. It seemed, as soon as I thought of it, it seemed really obvious that it should be bloody rhubarb.
Right.
But it took ages.
Well, that's been really, really useful, hasn't it?
Yes,
what fun as well.
Yes.
I can't wait to read the next one.
I'm waiting for that chicken to explain.
The good thing is that the chicken is called L, and because of its eggs and their trickery, that's why electricity is known as L's Eggs Trickery. And I was very childish.
Hi, Teresa here. I just want to wish you a very happy and creative new year, and to thank you for being part of Write Club the podcast. I'm truly amazed that you're out there listening, and I'm constantly astonished at the generosity of people in this writing world. Almost every writer, teacher, or publishing professional we've asked to participate has enthusiastically agreed. It's so difficult to single out one clip, but this advice from Liz Harris has stayed with me. Like Liz, I've just had a breakthrough in my plotting as a result of research.
The first thing I'd like to ask you is it really necessary to plot a novel?
Well, I would say in a single word, yes. I can't imagine what the novel would be like if you didn't plot it. But I think possibly novels that would fall into the genre of literary novels are more character-led than plot-led. So you could say, in that case, if you are writing a novel that is very character-led, then you could get away with not having much of a plot. I think you would need some thread of story, some thread of plot, though, to hold your characters together. So it's hard to imagine a book which has absolutely no plot at all. Mm. People ask you, what's your book about? And if you say, well, there's Joe and he's an eccentric, and there's Johnny and he's an eccentric, etc., etc., and you give the characterization, I don't think you would encourage many people to pick that book up. But if you can give a line of what the book's actually about, then you're part of the way towards selling it.
And do you use a particular method of plotting or a particular structure?
I know people do use things like Scrivener, and they follow charts, and they have ways of organising it, of dividing it. I don't do that because I write mainly historical. Generally, I start with the history. I start with the research, and I might start that before I even have a clear idea of storyline. For example, when I wrote The Road Back, it fell in my lap quite by chance. This was the first book I had published, although I had written others beforehand. Quite by chance, I came upon the fact that my late uncle had compiled an album when he had visited Ladakh in the 1940s, and he had photographs and details about his trip. It was very rare, I understood from my cousin, his daughter, for foreigners to be allowed into Ladakh. So I was very curious to read the album, which is now in England in the British Library on Euston Road in the Indian Room. But I had it for 2 weeks before I handed it over to the British Library. Mm-hmm. Fell in love with Ladakh, and I did have a character, a woman, in my head. So I knew I wanted to set the novel in the 1950s, I decided. Ladakh was not open in 1940s, 1950s, 1960s to tourists at all. So I felt that would be quite interesting to set a novel in the 1950s. And I had Patricia in my head, who came from a very sad family where something had happened a few years before she was born that very much affected the lives of her parents and obviously seeped through into her life. So Patricia was in my head. And I think a lot of people probably have characters in their head that are waiting to come out. So I started researching Ladakh. It's a province, an Indian province, and I didn't know what my main storyline, what my plot would be, until when I was researching the life, the social organization of the people who lived in the villages in Ladakh, I came upon the fact that because there is so little rain, it's a very high mountain plateau north of the Himalayas and west of Tibet, with so little rain, the social organization of the family reflected the difficulty of feeding too many people in the one house. And they had a way of organizing themselves that affected not the first three sons in the family, but the fourth son. The minute I found that, I had my story, my plot for Kaldam. Today, you could not do the journey my uncle did because it is kidnapped country. Very, very dangerous, Jammu Kashmir. But my uncle had described it in detail, and I was able to send my character, Patricia, and her father actually go to Ladakh, and they were able to follow my uncle's route. So if people read the book, they could do the journey in safety in bed or in the bedside chair, a journey that they really could not do today. But I focused the story actually in the Buddhist part. I thought the way they lived was absolutely fascinating. Illustration of finding a background of something you're interested in and bringing a story out of it. Historical novel or a novel set at a different time, a different place. I think it is completely pointless to pick up a fully formed story and plonk it there.
Yeah,
the background and what goes on at the time and the way people live should be organic in the novel.
Yeah, that's very good advice, I think.
I do think it should be. Otherwise, what is the point? You might just as well set the novel in the present day. Why go to the trouble of looking at a background if you're not going to use what you find?
And when you have your plot in place or in your mind, do you stick with it or are you flexible within that?
Yeah. I would say everybody, I would think, is probably, as I am, one likes to think one is the norm. You do have an idea, you form this idea gradually, but within it you're flexible. And the best way to describe it, I have described it this way before, is that you are starting from a train station and you know where the terminal will be, you know your destination, you know, as you're gradually researching the book, you find one or two things of particular interest, and you know you will use those in your story. So you know the key stations. Mm-hmm. What you don't know is how you're going to get to the different stations. When people talk about story and plot, the difference is the story is just the straightforward journey. The plot is actually how you get there. I think it would be very difficult to begin a book and not know where you're going.
As you know, we have a lot of fun creating Write Club the podcast. Linda cheered us up enormously with these extracts from rejection letters.
William Faulkner's Sanctuary was rejected with, "Good God, I can't publish this."
Rudyard Kipling, after he submitted a short story, received this one. I'm sorry, Mr. Kipling, but you just don't know how to use the English language.
Ooh, after he'd written that fantastic poem as well.
Lady Chatterley's lover, D.H. Lawrence, for your own sake, do not publish this book.
And for everybody else's, you have to endure it.
That's right. Herman Melville's masterpiece, Moby Dick, received a really, I thought this was so funny. It was turned down by multiple publishers. And then he received this letter from Peter J. Bentley, Bentley & Son Publishing House. It says, first, we must ask, does it have to be a whale?
What else is it going to be?
Well, he says, while this is a rather delightful, if somewhat esoteric, plot device, we recommend an antagonist with a more popular visage among the younger readers. For instance, could not the captain be struggling with a depravity toward young, perhaps voluptuous maidens?
That's strange.
Get rid of the whale. Let's get some
voluptuous.
Yeah.
Well, it's sublimated in Moby Dick, isn't it?
I suppose. And Gertrude Stein, we're all familiar with her. What is it? Postmodernist, I guess. It was ridiculous, I thought. But, you know, her famous quotes are, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. And then, there is no there, she's saying things. So she spent 22 years submitting before getting a single poem accepted.
Oh,
can you
word.
Imagine?
22 years.
That, yeah, and how dare we, you know, get discouraged after a year? Well, hopefully we don't write like that. But she received this rejection from the British publishing house, A.C. Fifield. After receiving one of her manuscripts, the founder of that wrote, I am only one, only one, only one. And he goes on, only one being, only one, having only one pair of eyes, having only one time, having only one life. I cannot read your manuscript three or four times, not even one time. Only one look is enough.
That's brilliant. That is so brilliant.
I like that.
Yeah, and T.S. Eliot was working at Faber and Faber. Well, I guess they're a very good and old and respected publishing house. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a largely apologetic rejection of Animal Farm to George Orwell. And he says in part, we have no conviction, and I am sure none of our other directors would have, that this is the right point of view from which to criticize the political situation at the present time. Your pigs are far more intelligent than the other animals, and therefore the best qualified to run the farm. In fact, there couldn't have been an animal farm at all without them, so that what is needed, someone might argue, was not more communism, but more public-spirited pigs.
Hi, this is Pat, and I'm wishing you a very happy new year. Looking back over this last year's podcasts, one of my favourite interviews was from episode 23, when we interviewed Andy Larter about writing groups. He talks about how valuable feedback is and how being in a group can really help to motivate you, to keep you going. And that certainly struck a chord with me.
I used to be a teacher. I retired just over 2 years ago. During my time as a teacher, one of the things that I, well, in the later part of my teaching career, was I set up the A-level writing, creative writing course at the college that I was working in. And I'd always kind of been interested in writing. I'd always sort of enjoyed messing about, writing poems and stuff like that with the students that I taught throughout my career. But I'd never really got anything finished. And then when I started teaching the A-level course, I met a couple of people who joined me in teaching it. And I sort of thought, you know, if I, when I've got a bit more time, I ought to really try and get something finished. And I thought, well, one way of doing that, to keep the pressure on me, myself, is maybe start a writer's group. See who's interested. I've got some mates who might be interested. And that's why it started, really. I thought it would help me get something done, some friends get something done, and there might be people in the area who could come along and support and get their own writing done as well. Because I know there are people who are interested in doing all kinds of different sorts of writing. So that's kind of why it started, just over 2 years ago. And in that time, the membership of the group has changed pretty radically. The people who came in the first place can't make it anymore, don't attend, and there are about eight of us now. There are eight of us who meet fairly regularly. They're not people who were there at the start. These are this is a changed clientele. We're amateurs, you know. We're not. Yeah. It's not a professional group or anything like that. We're not being paid to do it. But the commitments, and they change over time as well. Is we start at 6 o'clock in the evening once a week on the first Tuesday of the month, and we meet for 3 hours. And in those 3 hours, we divide the time up. So that the first hour is we give over to having a cup of tea and saying hello to each other, that sort of stuff. Then we do a short writing exercise. You know, one of those sort of, here's the opening sentence of a story. You've got 20 minutes to finish it kind of thing. Those sorts of things. And then we have a cup of tea. And then we look at writing that members of the group have submitted in the previous month. And what we do then is we each bring our own printed copy, which we've annotated. We talk about it in a specific amount of time and then hand the writing over. So that's the way that we do it, really. And it's, as I say, it's a three-hour meeting. I think it goes really quickly. Could do with another couple of hours, really, but there we go.
Or cut down on the chat at the beginning.
No. That's one of the most important bits.
Of course it is. Of course it is, having the catch up. Yeah. So what are the benefits for you and for the other members of the group?
I think it's the regular kind of contact with people who have been reading your work and know it over a period of time, know the kinds of things that you write about, know the sort of weaknesses that people have and the strengths. So try to sort of build those up and help them get over the other stuff. I think it's having some people who take it seriously, but not seriously so that they're going to hurt you or upset you. We have a lot of fun. We talk about all kinds of things. In the end, we know that we want to read each other's work, help each other do something with it. That more than anything else, really. For me as well, having that commitment every month to saying, right, I'm going to write between 1,500, 2,000 words that I want to submit and give people. Maybe say, you know, I've got a problem with this. Can you help me out? 2,000 words every month. I've got that kind of target and that sort of deadline. Really helps me do some writing. Because otherwise, I'll just get involved in chopping up some vegetables and playing with the grandchildren, going for walks, get out my bike, that kind of thing, rather than sit down and write.
Yeah. And how, when you critique one another, I mean, how pedantic and serious is the critique and the feedback?
Serious, because, well, one of the things that we do pick out things like internal flaws in. But then you say this at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We try to get over problems to do with, like, well, this bit didn't read particularly comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could do with thinking about how you present that love scene or that fight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We get pedantic about things like the choice of word. There was one, either the last meeting or the meeting before, where somebody had used a word that we thought was a bit controversial. We had a debate about that.
It wasn't politically correct, you mean?
Yes, yes. This is somebody in our group who writes sort of family history things, writing about somebody at the end of the Victorian era. And she used a word which would have been no problem in Victorian England, 2018. It could be problematic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we talked about that. I don't know what she's going to do with it. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, and that's the whole thing about critique, isn't it? You receive it, consider it, and then you take it or leave it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think now, after 2 years, the group's strong enough to know that that's the case. So we're not afraid of giving each other our work then. As far as things like punctuation and grammar and that sort of stuff and spelling mistakes goes, I think we do that on the paper and then hand it over. I'm not too bothered about that at that stage. Problem later on, I think.
I get Pat to do that for me.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what you think about that, though, but I've because when I taught the A-level, I always said to the students, I'm not interested in punctuation at this stage. What I'm interested in is, I want to see your ideas. Let's take it from there. There might be the meaning might be problematic if you put a comma instead of a full stop or something. But in the main, I don't give a monkey's. I really don't care, you know, yeah. At this stage. Later on, yeah. It becomes more problematic.
Yeah.
So it's like that, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to submit something, then you want to be sure that it's correctly punctuated and grammatically correct. But it's less important.
It's the first draft. We have our own Facebook page as well.
Oh, I'll look for that.
I got a request the other day for somebody wants to join our group. They live in Burma.
Ah. Right. Yeah. Well, send them to us, because that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to create a virtual Write Club. We have our own writing group, just like you.
And that has a private Facebook page.
Yes, that has a private Facebook page. But the Write Club, the podcast, is really about creating that virtual writing group.
Okay.
Encouraging people to share. So if you get people from Burma, please send them to us.
Okay. I get requests from people who say, I'm really keen on writing. I'd really like to join your group. It sounds fantastic. And then we never see them. Or we've had people come to one session, and then we've never seen them again.
Yeah, it's quite a leap of faith, isn't it, though, to put your work with people?
Oh, absolutely. And especially if you join a group where people know each other already.
Yeah, we kind of made a little manifesto between ourselves when we all got together about what we wanted to get out of it and how we were going to critique one another. Obviously, we now trust each other sufficiently, because I think we all understand that it's not to be unkind, it's to help us to be the best that we can be.
We're honest, and we have that. You know, personally, I didn't know the other members of the group particularly well, but those friendships now are really, really strong, and we do have a strong trust. And like you, we talk about all sorts of things that are nothing or not directly related to writing. We've had some quite deep sessions about family therapy.
I think when you're discussing certain sort of words, controversial words, that brings out all kinds of issues that are not necessarily to do directly with writing, but I think that's also a good personal.
Yes, absolutely.
Where do you meet?
We take it in turns to meet in one another's houses.
Right, okay. Because we meet at a local community hall.
Right. So does that cost money?
It does, yeah. Mm. But for the last, so far, the last 2 years, two and a bit years, I've managed to find funding.
Ah.
First year, I managed to find some funding from the local council. They paid us a sort of start-up money, which covered the whole year's rent. And for the last 2 years, a local literature charity. Have you ever heard of the Swindon Literature Festival? Quite a big event. Quite a big event. And there's a fella in town who organises that, and he gets money from all over the place. And he's given us enough money to cover the rent. I mean, it's what, 25 quid a meeting?
So I'm starting up a writing group, and I'm looking for funding. Where do I start?
Well, I'd look in places like that. Go to the council, see what they've got. You never know. I mean, what you're talking about, I don't know, 200, 250 quid?
Mm-hmm.
That's hardly anything, really, is it? I mean, to me it is.
Yes, but to the council it's very little. You're right.
And they might have a room somewhere or in the library or something like that. And there's another thing, the library. There's all kinds of things going on or not going on in libraries and spaces that might be or might not be being used. I did investigate that.
Yeah, brilliant.
Did you start your own group because there wasn't a group available that you could join, or did you want to own your own?
One of my friends kind of persuaded me that it'd be a good idea to set up our own.
Hi there, it's Steph here. When I look back over 2018 and remember all the people we met on Write Club, the podcast, the one message I keep getting over and over again is persevere, just keep writing. And being part of Write Club, the podcast, and talking to you all on Facebook really helps inspire and motivate me to keep at it. And I also value the tips and tricks our guests have shared, and I often go back to episodes to listen to those interviews again. One that really stuck in my mind was Tom Bromley. He's an author, a creative writing tutor at Faber Academy, director of fiction at the Professional Writing Academy, and an all-round top bloke to boot. He talked to us about the process of editing, that vital step before you send your work out into the cruel world.
you should approach the editing with a kind of creative hat on. I think sometimes when people write, it feels like that initial process of the writing is the fun bit, and then the editing is kind of hard work or a bit of a slog. But I think editing, when done properly, is actually a really creative part of the process, because you're thinking about your ideas, you're working out, you know, different ways that you can get those out as clearly as possible for the reader. And so for me, I think the key thing with editing, you need to get that whole draft down, because you need to see the script as a whole. I'd always resist the temptation to kind of edit as you go along. And once you've got that full draft there, for me, I have to do that on paper. So I need to print it out. I think it always feels different on the page than on the screen. You know, get your, you know, green pen, red pen, blue pen, whatever you use, and kind of scribble all over it, and then go back through. And I think the key thing for me with editing is about bringing those ideas out, and it's about pace. So I sometimes describe it as a sort of concertina process. So there'll be bits in the book when you go back through that need expanding, so you can really kind of bring out the kind of maximum drama in a scene. And there'll be bits as well where you need to kind of condense it down, because there's not as much happening. And so you get this, you know, widening and shortening kind of process throughout. And I think that really helps in terms of kind of pacing. I mean, I love, you know, everyone likes these different kind of writing maxims. I mean, two I really like is this idea of arriving late and leaving early. I think that's a screenwriting maxim, but I think it's a really useful one when you're editing as well. You know, are you sort of writing yourself into a scene and it's taking a bit long to get going? Are you in a scene, you know, the dramatic moment has finished and you're kind of dribbling on, and can you just kind of finish more quickly? I mean, usually, you know, there's ways you can do both of those. And I think going back to the concertina process, I think Lee Child said this, but it's this idea of writing the fast stuff slow and the slow stuff fast. So when you've got, you know, a fast moment, you know, give that to the reader in its, you know, in its full detail. And if you've got a slow moment, then whiz on past the next one. And I think if you can have all that in the back of your mind as you're editing, that will certainly help to shape your novel in a really good way.
And then at what point do I give you a ring and say, right, I need some professional help?
I think it varies from script to script. So there are, I mean, sometimes people ask me whether they need their manuscript edited before they send it to an agent or a publisher. And I don't think they do, because any decent agent or publisher is going to come back with changes. So if you've paid money to have it edited and then you go back and rewrite it, that editing is wasted. I think there's organizations like the Literary Consultancy or Cornerstones who do good, you know, manuscript overviews and assessment of the shape of the book. And I think it's before you submit, that might be something to consider. Sometimes you can get that from those kind of organizations. Sometimes if you've got a good group of writers who you work with, who you share your script with, from that sort of wisdom of crowds, you can get a lot of that information that way around as well. So I would say probably, although I'm probably talking myself out of a job here, is that you're only really go to those organizations when you're stuck. If you've got a script and you just can't see how to push it forwards, you need someone to unblock it, I would say that's usually the point to go to those manuscripts. I mean, the stuff I do for the Literary Consultancy, for example, usually the scripts come with a covering letter or someone saying, I don't know, I've sent it out to 10 agents, they've all rejected it. You know, can you tell me why? So it's more that part of the chain, but I think quite often if you've got a good group of writers who you share work with, you know, they will pick up the general points.
And you see, that's where I'm blessed, because I do have a good group of writers to work with. And not only am I part of the Write Club off air, and I know lots of you are also members of local writing groups, but now I've got the whole Write Club, the podcast community. So thank you very much indeed for all your support this past year. One of the things we say a lot is how much fun we have making the podcast. And we do. We have tremendous fun. It's also a lot of hard work, and we spend a long time editing out all the ums and ers and the mistakes and the bloopers to make sure that we sound erudite and don't give you false information. But just occasionally an episode has so much editing to do that we just leave the odd blooper in. And the episode when we spoke to Chris Heath about writing for children, which has already been covered today, at the very end we interviewed children about Chris Heath's books, and then Linda invited three of her numerous grandchildren to tell us what was on their bedside table. And the editing for that took forever because she kept making the poor children go over and over again. So if young Annika sounds a little bit fed up in this excerpt, you'll know why. And look out for the blooper at the very end of this extract. Hope you like it.
What's on your bedside table, Annika?
Wonder. It's about a boy who's getting surgery. And he has this little line on his face. He doesn't want to go to school. His mom is homeschooling him, and mom is really bad with fractions. I like the part how he looks.
Uh-huh. With the scar, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So who wrote the book?
Like, there's abbreviation, and the abbreviation is RJ. R.J. Palacio.
Sounds like a really great book for others to read. What is it that you really like about this book?
I like that he has a scar on his face, and his mom really wants him to go to school, but he does not want to go to school.
Why did you buy this book?
I didn't really buy it. It was in the school library.
Why did you pick that particular book?
Because a lot of other people got it. On the front, he had one eye, and the title was over his eye.
So that was a very attractive cover, right? Mm-hmm. Annika, yeah. Thank you so much. That was very, very good. It sounds to me like an interesting book. It's a boy who's had surgery and probably doesn't want to go to school because he's afraid people will laugh at him, I guess, huh?
Yeah, that's what it said in the book.
Okay, so, Annika, what's on your bedside table?
Okay, I'm Isabel.
I'm sorry, let me start again. I'm so sorry.
So, there you have it, all our favourite bits from 2018. I hope some of your favourites are in there too. You could do us one favour this new year. Go to your podcast provider and leave us a 5-star review. It really does help us grow the podcast. And maybe when you're out partying this new year, you might tell a friend about Write Club the Podcast and encourage them to join us. So all that remains is for me to wish you all a very, very happy new year and a very productive 2019. Bye.